And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor, a two-part show today. The second part of the show, we will be talking about Bradley Manning and the pre-trial hearings that are going on now. But we decided to go first to Michigan, where the right to work legislation passed yesterday, and it all happened very, very quickly. And we have two guests on the phone with us. We have Louise Somalski, who is a lobbyist for American Federation of Teachers in Michigan. Hello, Louise. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
And we also have John Hoadley, who is a campaign manager for Work in Michigan, which is a labor community coalition group. And thank you, John, for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us, Louise, what happened and why did it happen so quickly?
Well, we have our post-election legislative session days, and they're called lame duck, just like they are nationally in Congress. And it's their last-ditch effort to get anything done that they want to hurry up and push through before they end their legislative session. That's called signy die. At the end of the year, it could go as late as New Year's Eve, but they have very few legislative days, and the agenda is enormous, and right-to-work issue for public and private employees has come up and reached a fevered pitch, and the bills were moved. There was one bill moved in the House and two bills moved in the Senate yesterday evening. That would start this process. They then switch houses, so you've got technically all three bills are still sitting in the House because of some things that were done. But anyway, they can finish the legislative process on Tuesday when they come back in next week.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying that there's this fever to pass these real quick. Is that because the legislature will look very different come January?
No, we still will have a Republican governor, a Republican-held controlled Senate, a Republican-controlled House, and a Republican-controlled Supreme Court. There are a few less Republicans returning to the House next year, but they will still have a majority.
Mm-hmm. So this would have happened probably anyway.
They could have happened next session. It would have been a little harder for them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has reached a fevered pitch, and they sprang up in spite of a public outcry. They took bills that were already in motion. They changed the purpose of the bills, and they gutted them. In other words, they take out the words and put in different words. So there were no hearings, no public output. They locked the public out of the Capitol. They would not let them back in. They filled the galleries with Republican staffers so that our public could not watch the legislative process. It was a despicable display of democracy or lack thereof yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And John, how did the public and labor react?
I mean, as you can expect, people are upset. You know, when Governor Snyder decided to push this agenda at the very end of the year without a thoughtful discussion, his words, without a chance for the public to be heard, you know, people are angry. And, you know, a lot of people understand that they're being sold a bill of goods that aren't true, right? Whatever this Governor Snyder's freedom to work bill really is just going to mean freedom for lower wages, freedom to reduce benefits, you know, freedom to ship our jobs overseas. And that's going to hurt working families. You know, before we talk about specifics, it's just important to look to the past to see where we're going. And we know that in states that go down this path, the average worker, union and non-union, will make about $1,500 less. You know, for a lot of folks, $1,500 is a lot of money for me. Maybe not some of the one percenters, but definitely that's money that I want to keep in my pocket. And it's disappointing that without any conversation about what this is going to do to Michigan, they tried to pass it really quickly without that conversation.
Mm-hmm. And we have a caller who asked that I reframe the phrase and say right to work for less. I'm assuming you agree with that caller.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, they're speaking the truth.
Yes. I should let our listeners know that because of our kind of backwards technology, even though you've been helping us a lot with our technology, still not exactly up to par. We are not able to take callers for the first part of the show, but if you have questions for our guests, you're welcome to call anyway and ask Lois, who's answering our phones, to write them down, and she will bring them in to me. So how many people, how many citizens went to the Capitol yesterday, and what happened to them, John?
Yeah, so... and I appreciate the question, and then unfortunately I'm going to have to go because we are in the middle of mobilizing people. Here's what we know. Yesterday, at the drop of a hat, nearly 3,000 people turned out to the state's capital, which was all the more disappointing when they were locked out at one point. So literally thousands of people came to Lansing, to the capital, for their voices to be heard, and Governor Snyder was trying to pass his bill, said, you know, we don't want to listen to you. So, you know, right now, we're looking forward because we know that we've got a few days to really turn this around, and that's why we need people's help. We're going to be working with Michigan folks across the state to be talking to legislators back in their home districts. They didn't want to talk to us in Lansing. They can talk to us. We're going to talk to them in their hometowns and keep that conversation going. We know that on Tuesday, there's going to be a very big mobilization at the Capitol. I mean, literally thousands of people, because we have to be there to show that Michigan will hold our elected leaders accountable. You can't fundamentally attack the worker in Michigan, workers who build things and build our state, without there being consequences. And, you know, I think we're going to be seeing those.
Mm-hmm. And you have to leave us?
Unfortunately, I do. I just want to say, as a side note, we were so fortunate just the other night, as folks were staying in the Capitol to make sure that their voices were heard and stay there until the end, we received some pizza from our friends in Madison. So I just want to say thank you to your listeners who stood in solidarity with us, and we really appreciate it.
You know, our Facebook posts and all that are full with solidarity with Michigan, and I will ask Louise about the kind of inspiration you possibly got from us. But I guess we'll let you go and organize and wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. John Hoadley, campaign manager for Working Michigan, which is a labor community coalition group. And we are going to talk with Louise for a few more minutes. And now, actually, you can call if you like to talk to her, 256-2001-1866-899-WORT. Please do not call if you have called in the past 7 days. So John was talking a bit about you can't do it in Michigan, etc. Michigan actually has a very strong history of unions, doesn't it, Louise? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we have the auto industry. This is their home and their place of origin, and we have the famous sit-down strike in Flint, and so we have a long and rich history, and that has built the middle class here in Michigan and has allowed people to provide for their families and to be able to work and purchase things and take care of their families and pay taxes. And so we've had a wonderful state because of the middle class here. And this is just this is a huge blow to working families being able to provide for their working people to provide for their families, as John laid out. And it's just, it's a very sad, sad day. And just to let you know that there were all shenanigans that went on at the Capitol. They
did what they
call call of the House, which they literally locked the legislators into their respective chambers. They were not allowed to leave. They were not allowed to come out and speak with their constituents that were here. that had driven in to see them. And it will probably happen again on Tuesday, where these people will make the trip into Lansing to view the process and to speak with their legislators, and they will not be able to do so. So it is good that people are reaching out to them at home mm-hmm. over the course of the weekend because they can't be locked into the Capitol at home.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the involvement of Alec and the Koch brothers, both in the legislation itself and in these tactics that you are describing, which are just, I think that if we've heard about something like that happening in Cuba, it would be a reason for the United States to go to war with.
It would be. This is template legislation that we've seen from Alec that they give to legislative bodies all across the country. They have learned, unfortunately, from their experience in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they put an appropriation in these bills, which makes them referendum-proof. We cannot take them to
the voters really?
And say, would you like to repeal this nasty piece of legislation? Mm. So those kinds of things were learned, unfortunately, from the other states and are being used here in Michigan.
Uh-huh. And what, if anything, has the labor movement in Michigan learned from a big part of the citizenry?
Well, we've got our mobilization strategy that we're using. We tried, we asked for some amendments on the bills as they were moving. We've done everything legally we can to either strike down portions of the bills, remove the appropriation, but those were all defeated mm-hmm. last night.
Yeah. We have a caller for you, Louise. Let's get to that person. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Obviously, as everybody knows by now, these agendas are coming. The same agenda is coming from Alec and Americans for Prosperity and these national groups that are determined to destroy the public sector. That is really, really shocking because, as everybody knows, legislators and governors take an oath to defend the Constitution of their states and, by extension, the Constitution of the United States and to represent their constituents. And they're absolutely doing the opposite of this. And the 100,000-plus demonstrators in Madison were finally told, it's over and time to leave now peacefully, and they did, and the unions didn't call a general strike. I think that was the difference between the demonstrations in Wisconsin, maybe in the rest of this country, and the demonstrations in the Middle East. There, the people didn't just, docilely or politely sit down and say, goodbye, okay, we know that we haven't won. They stayed in the streets. Do you think that this kind of civil disobedience and, if necessary, violence is going to be necessary to stop this steamroller in the United States?
Louise.
Wow. I'd like to say that we could pull something like that off. I know it's been talked about. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But there is, as far as I know, there is no general strike being organized here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Well, the caller mentioned Obama, and Obama has made his opposition to right-to-work legislation known. Is there a way to legislate against it on the federal level?
Perhaps. In a limited way. I'm not privy to those conversations going on right now. We've just been dealing here with the state level, but I'm sure those discussions have started will continue.
Mm-hmm. So give us some more details about what's included in the legislation. What is going to happen to private sector and to public sector workers once this passes?
Sure. Unions will still exist, but it will change in that members are not required to belong, which in public sector they are not required to belong now. It is their choice. What the difference is right now, if they choose not to belong, because they have an objection to belonging to a union, they pay a fair share because they are benefiting from the contract provisions that have been negotiated on their behalf, such as their health care coverage and their salary, their vacation time, and so on. And they are also covered by a provision if they would be have some difficulties at work and would like someone to be in a meeting with them on their behalf to assist them. And so that's what the fair share is, to cover those kinds of things, because there is a cost to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
This would prohibit that. And so if they chose not to belong, and they didn't, they would not have to pay a fair share amount. And so by not having to belong and not having to pay, it weakens the ability of the union that represents the members, the people who do want to belong, to be able to have voice, the collective voice of the entire group, and to speak for them as one group. And it's also harder for human resource directors, because they like dealing with the union representation, because it's a one-stop shopping, so to speak. They would go to that the HR director would go to that union representative and say, you know, we've got this problem or that problem, and let's work on it together with one voice representing the entire group. And now they will no longer have the ability, the fortunate and streamlined ability to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And how would that cause deterioration in wages, benefits, pensions, etc.?
Well, you don't have that collective voice, so they will start to deteriorate what they negotiate and are able to put together through the collective bargaining process, because the group is diminished in size. And with a collective voice. And we have seen in other states when this happens that eventually wages and benefits deteriorate and are reduced.
Mm-hmm. And Michigan is the 24th state in the United States to have passed a right to work law, so-called, right to work for less. How do you think the fact that Michigan has fallen might affect other states?
Well, it's in the opposition's quiver, it's a huge win for them. And I just want to make everybody aware that we're not done yet. We
right.
still have a legislative process to go through, although it's going to be hard on Tuesday to be able to stop this steamroller, but we are certainly going to pull out all the stops and try. It's not done until the governor signs it, or perhaps not sign it. That mm-hmm. remains to be seen, but we're gonna try every way we can to get this prevent this from happening. But yes, it will be a huge win to have a labor powerhouse. That is Michigan, fall to right to work.
Mm-hmm. So as a lobbyist for the American Federation of Teachers in Michigan, what is next for you? Assuming that it is passed, assuming that the governor does sign.
We're going to have a lot of meetings and regroup and figure out how to best serve our members and maybe a little bit different strategy on making sure our members see the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be reintroducing them to the benefits that they receive by belonging to a union.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Louise, before we let you go?
No, thanks for the support in Wisconsin, and we appreciate you calling us and asking how things are going. It was amazing, the lack of democracy yesterday. It was disgusting. Quite
mm-hmm.
frankly, to be locked in and locked out of the Capitol, and lack of discourse and the shenanigans that went on were
astounding. Yeah, we've been through that. We still are. We know that there are at least 5 buses that are going from Wisconsin to support you there in Michigan. Thank you so much, Louise Somalski, lobbyist for American Federation of Teachers in Michigan. Thanks.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And we'll be going next to Kevin Gostola. He's a journalist who's been covering the Bradley Manning pretrial hearing. While we call him, I just want to let you all know that I'll be leading a workshop called Letting Go, Letting In. It's a 4-hour meditation and various spiritual and physical exercises, and that'll happen on Saturday, December 15, from 1 to 6. That's 5 hours because there is an hour of a feast after we let go and let in. This is in time for the new year and for the end of the Mayan year. And you may remember that we had Mayan shamans on this show sometime, and what they told you is that, what they told us is that this is not the end of the world. It's the end of one era, the way they understand it, and the beginning of another one that will have a lot more collaboration and working together, and the end of greed and such, as they see it. So this workshop will be intended to help us let go of the things we really don't need anymore and let in new things. It's at the Center for Conscious Living, Saturday, December 15, from 1 to 6 p.m. If you want to know more about it, call me after the show, 256-2001, or look for it, look for Letting Go, Letting In on Facebook, or look at the website of the Center for Conscious Living. Do we have our next? We do. We do have Kevin Gostola with us. He's a journalist who's been covering the Bradley Manning pretrial hearing, co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. He blogs at dissenter.firedoglake.com. And hello, Kevin. Thank you so much for taking time from covering this trial and talking to us.
Hello. Thank you.
So what's the latest? What's been going on in the pretrial hearings?
I guess the latest is this morning, Bradley's, the brig officer in charge who was there from mid-January on through April 20th, 2011, when Manning was transferred to Leavenworth. She's been on the stand giving testimony. And then yesterday we had Ava Hart. His name is CW04, James Ava Hart, and he was the brig officer in charge from the time that Manning got to Quantico, July 29th, 2010, through to middle of January. So, I can step back and give some background. The motion, you know, being deliberated here in this hearing has been on unlawful pretrial punishment. The defense has come with this motion alleging that Manning was mistreated and should not have been, and they have been putting forward evidence, and then the government has been there trying to rebut, and the defense would like an outcome of either the charges dismissed or they would like a 10-to-1 credit. So the days that Bradley is found, if the judge would find there were days where he was punished, if the judge would say, okay, if there's like 20 days, then they would like 200 of those to be credited to him so you could have a reduction of sentence. And he was there for over 200 days. He was held in Quantico.
Mm-hmm. And all in all, he's been in confinement for over 900 days. What have we been hearing about the conditions of that confinement?
What we've been hearing is that first he was classified as a maximum custody detainee. This is a classification usually for dangerous, violent detainees, especially ones that pose an escape risk, would have been a threat to national security. And then I will also add he was put on prevention of injury status, which means that's a clinical psychiatric status. And a doctor, his name was Dr. William Hochter, a Navy captain, assessed him, and he was the first doctor, was assessing him and would make determinations about that. He was placed on suicide risk when he first came because of some of what went on in Kuwait prior, but when he got to the brig, he was there for 11 days, he was on suicide risk, and then they gradually took him off of that, and then he was... The psychiatrist constantly, from about August, end of August through to January, was making these recommendations that Manning should be removed from this POI status, which both of these things, the max custody and POI, gives the Quantico brig a lot of leeway to impose restrictive custody conditions on Manning. That's what they were able to do was, for example, limit his access to toilet paper. Someone's always checking on him. Every 5 minutes he has to say, answer the question, are you okay? He's not allowed to have items in his cell because they could be a risk. Things like that. Limited recreation time. Not allowed to move around in the brig. If he gets moved out of his cell, he has to have leg restraints, a belt around his waist. He has to have his hands in cuffs. He has to wear these restraints while he's out on outdoor recreation. Or he has to at least have handcuffs indoor rec, so he can only do the treadmill and not the bicycle. Things like that that restrict his ability to move in the brig.
Mm-hmm. And those allegations of torture, what would that entail?
I mean, this all goes to it. I don't know if I would use the word torture, although. I think it all adds up to torture. There's no, like, individual instance. From what I've been seeing, the argument that the defense is making, if they were going to say torture, was that this all adds up. So that some total, and the fact that you have these officers, this is what has been coming out, the fact that you have these officers having the knowledge that this is a high-profile case, getting a lot of media attention, and what the defense has been presenting are these emails where you have officers from the Marine Corps chain of command going all the way up, some of them being well aware of little things that are going on with Bradley Manning as a detainee, and they were in on developments that typically they would not be on with other prisoners that maybe did something as simple as, you know, they were a deserter or they committed an assault, and so they're being held in pretrial confinement for a court-martial coming up. So they were in on these very small decisions just because they wanted to be there, and then, you know, their thoughts about Manning being a potential suicide risk were included in decision-making, and that is, the defense has been saying, has played a role in keeping him in those conditions.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that Bradley Manning himself has had an opportunity to speak. What has he said, and also how does he seem? How is his mental health? How is his physical health after these 900 days of very harsh treatment?
Well, I would say that, you know, physically I didn't notice anything from watching him sit there in the witness stand. I didn't notice anything mentally. He seemed to still be a pretty sharp and astute, intelligent individual, capable of answering the questions that were put to him. It's clear from seeing Bradley Manning up on the stand and also hearing stories, anecdotes from the officers that worked at Quantico, that Bradley Manning is a very intelligent person. He also is someone who is maybe sometimes a little too smart for his own good, but he had anxiety disorder when he was in Kuwait. He got diagnosed for that. Maybe he's had some mental problems, but it's clear that he has his wits. He's not somebody who appeared to be this broken individual. He's very able to put his complete thoughts forward, and what he was describing from the stand was very profound and vivid. Particularly, I would say, in my opinion, I was struck by the confinement conditions he experienced for the 2 months while he was in Kuwait. That's not part of the unlawful pretrial punishment motion. But nonetheless, as a journalist who has covered this closely and had no idea what he had experienced, he was arrested May 27, 2010, in forward operating base Hamer in Iraq, and he got transferred to Camp Arifjan in Kuwait. And there he described how he was put basically in what he called an animal cage. And in this cage, he was there for a few days when they brought him in. They moved him out. He got to be with some of the other pretrial detainees, but they messed with his clock, his biological clock. They had him getting up at night around 10 p.m., 11 p.m., and they had him going to sleep about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This is this is kind of what they might do to a prisoner being held at Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. Eventually he was put in segregation. He was in this small cage-like cell. He described how he was afraid he was going to die in this cage. And there were officers that would storm into his cell. They would do what he called a shakedown. They would just throw everything in his cell all around. And then they would leave, and it was not clear what they were looking for. It's probably fair to say they were just intimidating him and trying to send some kind of a message. Mm-hmm. So when eventually he got moved, he was actually frightened. He didn't know that he was going to go to the continental United States. He hadn't been told what his charges were. There wasn't anything definitive, and he believed he might have been transferred to Guantanamo Bay or Djibouti. And he was very happy, he said, from the stand when he landed at Baltimore Washington International Airport and was on his way to Quantico.
Why Djibouti?
Because it's it's another place that the United States has a military base, pretty secretive, conducting covert operations. There hasn't been much discussion in the media, but it uses, and there's not a whole lot known about it, but it is where they launch U.S. drone strikes. It is where they're using it as a launch pad. Maybe he knew something about prisons being held there, and it wouldn't be a stretch to presume that there are maybe Somalis or other people from Africa that are suspected of terrorism being held there. So that was his perception from within the military, that he could end up at any of these locations. He did not think that what people had been talking about in regards to him meant that he was going to be treated like, this wasn't just some small offense that they believed he had committed.
Mm-hmm. And did he speak at all about why he thinks he's been getting such harsh treatment?
I think that's his frustration. It came up multiple times that he would try to ask the officers, why are you concerned? Why are you keeping me in these conditions? Why? And they wouldn't give him a reasonable answer. He spoke in one vivid exchange that has become a key part of the proceedings. He went back and forth with a master sergeant and basically expressed that he thought they were looking for anything they could find to say he was of concern, just so that they could keep him in those confinement, in those conditions. And so he was working with his lawyer. He was trying to go through official channels. He'd even go before a board that was reviewing his confinement conditions every week. And he would say, he did this like 3 times in the period between January and February 2011. And he was presenting all this, all these records that show he's a good behaved detainee. He's getting good marks when they review what he does inside of the brig, but yet he's really confused about why they're keeping him in these conditions.
Mm-hmm. And what is your take on why?
Listening to the total and listening to the officers take the stand, there have been some very interesting details that have come out about the fact that they knew Manning had committed an offense that was a national security type offense, the releasing of classified information. And they have described things like not wanting Manning to interact with other detainees and discuss his charged offenses. You're not wanting him to be, this is what the commanding officer, Ava Hart, said yesterday, was that he didn't want Manning in the general population because he knew other prisoners were, quote, very patriotic, end quote, and that they would, they were very well aware of what Manning was alleged to have done, and there possibly could have been some provoking of Manning, and or Manning may have been provoked and then hit back out at them, and there could have been disturbances in the prison over Manning. And so I get the sense from listening to officers talk about this that they might have been, and this is where it really becomes evident that you have a case for an unlawful pretrial punishment motion. It looks like they might have been using Manning's mental health issues as a cover, and then what they really wanted to do was just keep him separated from the general population because they were afraid that he would mix and maybe talk about what he might have done. I don't know, maybe describe the information, because the military really wouldn't want other soldiers to know what Manning had read and released to the world.
Mm-hmm. The numbers here are 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORT, should you care to join the conversation and haven't called in the past 7 days. My guest is Kevin Gostola. He's a journalist covering Bradley Manning, the pretrial hearing. He blogs at dissenter.firedoglake.com, and he's co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. So we've been talking about the pretrial hearing, Kevin. My engineer is saying, and rightly so, most of the attention of the defense focuses on the harsh treatment during imprisonment, but are they going to also bring the crimes and atrocities that were committed by the military and the government, which are the reasons for him to have done the whistle blowing, or is it all going to stay in the area of his treatment?
Well, no. I mean, it's a pretrial hearing, so this is what they have to go through because of how they have handled the process up to this point. Similarly, there will be a hearing on a speedy trial motion, arguing that he has been unfairly held in these conditions for a long, long period of time. They won't be discussing the nature of it because that's what this hearing is about. But they'll be talking about the many times when the government has continued to push the date of the trial or push the date of the major pretrial hearing that was held back in December 2011, because as you said at the front, we're closing in. 900 to 1,000 days is where we're at around now that he's been in pretrial confinement. And then in the main trial, you know, they're going to address the charges that have come up. I think in the closing argument, maybe in the opening and here and there, David Coombs, Manning's defense lawyer, is definitely going to raise some of what you're talking about, the whistleblowing of seeing this information. He's spoken about Manning's idealism and Manning seeing this information before and what it would have meant to somebody young to see this, to think that maybe they could change the world by sharing this with other people.
Mm-hmm. So we are starting to lose you there on your cell. Let's get to that issue. Bradley Manning, of course, is being tried, and I guess we should have said it right at the beginning, for leaking, for allegedly leaking, though I believe he has actually admitted to having done that during the pretrial hearing. Many documents that show atrocities that the United States has either committed itself or has been partial to or allowed to happen. Let's talk a little bit about the importance of what he has allegedly released. What are some of the things that we learned about through his whistleblowing?
And as you're saying, he's put forward what you're alluding to there is this conditional plea he's trying to get the judge to accept, and he has pled to some lesser offenses in the charges and hoping, you know, that the judge would accept it and saying, I accept some responsibility. I did pass some information to WikiLeaks in this plea that has been put forward. And the information that, you know, made the headlines throughout 2010 was, I'll just briefly go through the April 2010, you have the collateral murder video. You have this 2007 Apache helicopter attack of some Reuters journalists being gunned down, and then a van coming to try and rescue them and being shot up as well, and two children being hurt in this. And in July, there were the Afghanistan war logs that had some reports talking about, I think there was an assassination squad that was detailed, talking about this grouping that would have been conducting night raids. Then in later on in October, you have the Iraq war logs, and here you have, importantly, an order, Frago 242, that the military was going to look the other way if they handed detainees over to Iraqi, I'll call them death squads, and they were going to torture these individuals. The U.S. military had an order to not take responsibility. In December 2010, there's the U.S. State Embassy cables that get released, and these come out throughout the whole entire month of December on through the month, early months of 2011, and you have many different stories that are coming out about communications between the United States State Department and other foreign officials. Just some of the things off the top of my head is just, for example, the Yemeni president saying that he will claim that the bombs were his country's and not America's when drones were striking in Yemen. Also, you have the corruption in Tunisia being detailed, and you have aspects of government in Egypt being detailed. Right when these uprisings are occurring and having some kind of influence on those revolutions, uprisings.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also Gitmo files, Guantanamo files, detainee assessment reports for all the individuals that were being held at Guantanamo Bay, and then talking about the military's justifications for keeping them imprisoned.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, you are fading very quickly. I think we should probably let you go back to covering the trial. Thank you so very much for joining us and reporting to us about what's going on, and we'll keep in touch with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that's Kevin Gostola, journalist covering Bradley Manning, the pretrial hearing. He has previously written the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. And he blogs, and you can follow up what he is following at dissenter.firedoglake.com. And we're going to open the phones to you for the last 8 minutes or so to talk about whatever you want to talk about. It'll be a quick open line. But one of the questions that I would like to investigate and to discuss with you is to put these two stories that we've been covering most of this hour, the one about the ramming of right-to-work legislation in Michigan and all the insane tactics that have been used in Michigan to make sure that this happens. And of course, what we remember very well from Wisconsin and what is still going on in Wisconsin, and put that together with the story of Bradley Manning and both what he has uncovered about the role of the United States in the world and the way he's been treated currently, and really has been treated for almost 3 years. And what does all of this say about the state of American democracy, about the state of American governance, about what's going on in this country? Where is it going, and what can we as just citizens, what can we as people who are not in positions of power, what can we do to stop this slide rightward and into something that, to me at least, seems very undemocratic? 256-2001-1866-899-WORT. We don't have any callers. You guys have nothing to say. That is absolutely stunning. I know it is December and everything, but you'd expect to get some people to share their opinions. Julian Assange, talking about Bradley Manning, was saying that what he has revealed, his leaks, have shown the real aims of the United States around the globe, U.S. subversion of democratic processes around the world, systematic evasion of accountability for atrocities and killings, an aggressive policy of coercion used by the United States in the pursuit of its strategic, commercial, and political goals worldwide. It seems to me like all of these actually really relate to what's going on in Michigan currently, what was and still going on in Wisconsin, and what's going on throughout this country now that the chickens have come home to roost. So we do have a caller. You are welcome to call, too. I think we can get maybe a couple more still this hour. Try us. Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Esty, thank you. You're such a wonderful person. Chicken comes home to roost. Oh, Malcolm X would just love you for that. And basically, well, that's you. What this conversation is about, really. I would like for all of us to Google Willie Lynch, and you will see how the economy of America has been created and the mentality that still exists in this country. As long as white supremacy and its tool of racism governs us as a collective, we are going to continue to have these issues, period. We can put a period on that. And it is up to the collective to change. Nothing ever occurs from the top down. As long as we are, continue to allow for the indoctrination that has been forced upon us in America, we will have these issues, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, you say white supremacy, as long as white supremacy continues, nothing will change. And I certainly do not disagree with you, but we have actually a black man leading this country right now. And
excuse me, President Obama is not black. Obama is the president of America. He's not black. And black is nothing. There's no such thing as a black land. There's no such thing as black people. The only black people you find are in America. The only white people you find are in America. When you leave America, you're no longer white. You are whatever your people were. When you leave America, you're not black. And this concept, that's the concept that has to be totally eliminated. Either I'm going to be a productive American citizen, period, or I need to find someplace else to live. And I'll give you my number. I have a passport. If you'd like to contribute to that, I will be more than happy to accept donations. I am the only entity in America that did not ask to be American. Think about it. I was forced into it.
That is true.
And I'm not unproductive. I am a United States Marine honorably discharged with 32 confirmed kills. I think that qualifies me to be able to have an opinion.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel nowadays about having been a Marine and having killed all these people?
I don't feel nothing. That's what you paid me for. Excuse me? Don't try to put it off on me.
No, I'm just asking feel. I certainly have not paid
America
you for that.
America prepared me wonderfully well. And in that course of my activity in the Marine Corps, that happens. I mean, why would you join the Marine Corps, actually, if you didn't want to kill nobody? Excuse me?
So
you're talking about an American mentality. You're talking about an American mentality that's been prepared by John Wayne, and the cavalry comes in and kill the Indians. Come on, man.
Yeah, that's what one starts with.
Americans are the greatest mass murderers of all times.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
thank you.
You can put a period on it. And we're basically still so low-life that we solve all our conflict resolutions with violence.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling. We do have another caller. Let's get to that person quickly before the hour ends. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
I think it's important to focus on the current round of horse manure that's been pretty evident in this country for a while. And the biggest problem to me is post-racist, which is hysterical, because even as life expectancy kind of levels out for most folks, if you look at the United States, you'll find that the life expectancy of a black male is 6 or 7 years longer in Cuba than it is in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
We do well to give credence to the great Fannie Lou Hamer's brief description of what's going on, the land of the tree and the home of the grave.
Well, thank you. We are practically out of time, I think. We have another caller, but what time is it, Mark? Do we have a minute? Half a minute, caller. Go ahead.
Hi. What compelled me to call was hearing that why would you join the Marines if you didn't want to kill? I joined the Marines and I didn't want to kill. And I think that's true of probably a huge majority of people that were in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Michigan, I think the left has to figure out that they were outsmarted. And I think they've gotten pretty complacent since Election Day. It's time to start going on the defensive.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for calling. We are out of town. I think we should do a show about the American military and other militaries and those of us who have served in them, myself being one of them, we haven't done that in quite a while, so maybe I'll look into that sometime soon. I am Estee Dinor. Thank you, Mark and Lois, for your help, and Anjali and Molly. I will be talking to you again next week. Thank you for calling. Bye-bye. My